Welcome to episode 128 of the Headspace and Timing podcast. Today, I had the honor and pleasure of having a conversation with Dr. Keita Franklin, the National Director of Suicide Prevention for the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs Office of Mental Health and Suicide Prevention. Dr. Franklin and her team are not focused just on intervening when a veteran is considering taking their own life, but on putting measures in place to prevent veteran suicide. We talk about the need for education and advocacy in both the provider community and the communities at large.
It just speaks to how complex this issue is and how we need to provide ongoing training for our own field, but equally so get others comfortable as asking the question, are you thinking of ending your life? And understanding what to do if someone says yes, like you must take action. Don't leave them alone. Get them to help. This is a critical time. And I think as a nation, if we got to a place where we were able to make a further dent around stigma reduction and get people more comfortable talking about suicide risk in a way that's helpful, and I think that we could make a change with that little step as well.
Welcome to the Headspace and Timing podcast, a show dedicated to breaking down the stereotypes around veteran mental health. My name is Dwayne France, and I'm a retired Army non-commissioned officer and a combat veteran of both Iraq and Afghanistan. After retiring from the Army, I took on a new mission as a clinical mental health counselor for my fellow service members. If you served in any branch of the military, then you're familiar with the M2 machine gun, the 50 cal. It's one of the most effective weapons in the military's arsenal. If the weapon's headspace and timing wasn't set correctly, however, it was just a useless chunk of metal. Veterans can be rendered inoperable if their headspace and timing's not set correctly either. That's my goal with this show, to change the way that we think and talk about veteran mental health and reduce the stigma against seeking support. Each week, we'll talk with mental health professionals, veterans, and those who support service members, veterans, and their families. We're going to have real and honest conversations about a topic that most just don't like to talk about, veteran mental health. Let's jump into this week's conversation. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Headspace and Timing podcast. Once again, and as always, we really appreciate you taking the time to listen and learn more about veteran mental health. When we talk about veteran mental health, unfortunately and inevitably, the conversation comes to eventually veteran suicide. We all know the veteran suicide epidemic. The numbers have been static over the last several years, even approaching a decade now. And I'm really honored and appreciative to be able to bring on Dr. Keita Franklin, who is the National Director of Suicide Prevention for the Department of Veterans Affairs. So in the VA, Dr. Franklin is the person who's speaking about suicide prevention. So Keita, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, again, I really appreciate you taking your time, realizing how busy it is, but also recognizing that any of these conversations that you're having, as many conversations we can have about suicide prevention, is beneficial. But I'd like to give you an opportunity to tell the audience a little bit about yourself and sort of how you came to this particular line of work.
Sure, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. And I am a social worker by training. My father was active duty in the United States Navy, and I grew up on Navy bases around the world and largely in New England and towards his latter years. But I grew up in the military culture and had a keen interest in understanding the stressors that are placed on military families early on in my career. And so I have a master's degree in social work and a PhD in social work, where I was fortunate to study during the middle of the war effort the impact of post-traumatic stress disorder on family relationships and even parent-child relationships. And so that sort of focused my career around trauma and PTSD. And from there, then I became even more interested in suicide and suicide prevention. And I spent most of my time working with the active duty side across various branches of the military and at the headquarters level with the Marine Corps before spending some time in the Pentagon. And now I'm on a mission here over in the Department of Veteran Affairs, working, as you said, with veteran suicide issues and trying to move the needle on this important issue.
You know, I always appreciate how clinicians come to working with veteran mental health specifically. And like you said, it usually is a family connection. you know, spouse or child or even service member themselves. And like you, my father is a veteran or was a veteran. He passed away from natural causes several years ago. Mm-hmm. But for a long time, this was the suicide. He was a Vietnam veteran. And actually, I've mentioned to it on the show, when I was on active duty, the first suicide intervention I ever conducted was with my father, which was really set me down this path of working with veterans in mental health, but also recognizing I, as a combat veteran, and this is obviously probably not something that you haven't heard before, but I've lost more of my soldiers or people that I deployed with to suicide than we actually did during combat. And that's a significant issue. And that's something that a lot of veterans are experiencing, is losing more of their battle buddies to suicide after deployments.
Yes, it is. And I appreciate you bringing it up, because I've read that myself as well. And I think that people sometimes think it's one simple reason, one simple risk factor, we would say in mental health, on that brings somebody to the point where they die by suicide. And what we know is that it's multiple reasons. And sometimes it's upwards of 20 reasons all interacting together, in the absence of, you know, feeling overwhelmed and in the absence of protective factors, it can result in a death by suicide. And so it is so complex, and sometimes it's difficult to compare one versus the other. But when we see those statistics that show that, you know, more people have died, more veterans or service members have died by suicide than by wartime injuries, it is startling, and it does, you know, send us to a place, I think, of a call to action around the issue, for sure.
Right. And I definitely, that's what I've started to hear, of course, in the research showing that the paths that veterans take to that, it's very challenging, because it's almost, I don't want to say it's unknowable. We know what the risk factors are, but it can be very challenging to say that you can have all the risk factors and still never go to the point of taking your own life. Before we maybe get into that technical things, I'd like to maybe give you an opportunity to give an overview of sort of the VA suicide prevention program in your office, and sort of what you do now.
Sure, absolutely. The program was set up, I want to say, close to 12 years ago, largely focused on a crisis intervention capability, our veteran crisis line, and putting suicide prevention coordinators at every VA medical facility in the nation. And I think that was largely also where the science was at the time. It was, the thoughts around suicide prevention were, we definitely need a crisis capability, and we need strong mental health providers. And if we have those two things, we can make a difference, and we can identify people at risk, and we can do something about it by bringing them into our hospital system and treating them. And so the VA's model was stood up by Dr. Jan Kemp. I would be remiss in not mentioning her. She was the founding leader in this space well before my time, and was such a big champion of suicide prevention. But the program has evolved over the years, and we've added new and additional capabilities. And we're pivoting here of recent, in the last year and a half, even more so on this trajectory that the VA has been on, towards a public health approach. And so we're trying to think through and to execute programming for all 20 million veterans. And I say that because it's important, because not all of those 20 million veterans receive their health care in our VHA, our Veteran Health Administration healthcare hospital-based system. So, you know, I said 20 million, it's 19.9 million, and almost 2 million of those are women. But we are designing our programming towards all of them. And then we are trying to better understand the pockets of individuals that are at risk at the group level. And we're working on additional interventions that I can talk to you about for those. And then trying to continue our good work for those that are at the individual level. And those are the ones that usually are coming to us through our veteran crisis work, or indirect engagements with our hospital system, with our suicide prevention coordinators, and also through a capability that you may have heard of called ReachVet. I can talk to you more about that, but that's a bit of a predictive analytic tool that we use to further identify risk in our veterans that are seeking healthcare in our hospital system. So all of that to say that the program is really focused broad and far on interventions across the spectrum of everybody, writ large, individuals that are at risk at the group level, and then singular individuals as well. Does that make sense?
Yes, it absolutely does. And as I'd mentioned before we started talking, me as a community mental health provider that works closely with the VA, have seen all of these things and definitely appreciate that it's not just for VA vets, right? You know, the as you said, the veterans in the VA healthcare system. I, as a retiree, I get most of my healthcare through, I'm right outside of Fort Carson, right? So I get it through my, my on-post provider. You of course have veterans that may not be eligible for the VA one way or another. They don't have service connected and they have an income that's higher. And this is really a misnomer or a misconception a lot of people have, is that all veterans should be able to go in the VA. And that 19 million, I mean, there's no way that one organization can support all that. So I really appreciate the idea of, reaching more of those, and not just the veterans, but the clinicians themselves. So starting with that, with the public health approach, and again, as we were talking briefly before, this is something that we as a community here in Colorado, and definitely with the support of the VA, has started to look more at. I'd like to hear more about what you and your office are considering these public health approaches to addressing the veteran suicide epidemic.
Yes, thank you. One thing I should have said that I think gets after the heart of this, and it builds on something that you said about also about veterans having health care through our VHA system or not. When 20 veterans a day die by suicide, six of those have touched our VA healthcare system in the days and months leading up to their death, and 14 have not. And so that data point, while a singular data point, is important, because if 14 have not touched our healthcare system, it really is a sign for us that we've got to push our interventions outside the four walls of our hospital-based system. And so some of the ways that we're trying to do that is to work with our suicide prevention coordinators to have them join local coalitions. Coalitions with counties and towns and mayors and states, and work collaboratively with suicide experts that are outside of the VA system to design interventions where the way that we're talking about it is where veterans work, live, and thrive, so that we're not just capturing them where they get healthcare. Certainly where they get healthcare is important, and we won't stop that work, but also engaging with them where they work, live, and thrive. In such a matter through these coalitions where we believe that there's no wrong door for care. And so if they want to get care through their own insurance, we want to help make that happen. If they want to get care through a peer support model or through complementary therapies, really we want it to be unique to the veteran, and it doesn't have to be in our system. Although we do know that when veterans come to VHA, they do receive better care than they would outside of that system. And, you know, that was documented in a recent National Academies of Science report. But we just don't want barriers or feelings about the VA to in any way hinder somebody coming into care. But beyond coalitions, we're also encouraging all of our suicide prevention coordinators and here at the National Office as well to develop partnerships. You know, we have over 68 partnerships right now with various veteran service organizations and nonprofit organizations that are helping us. And each partner comes to the table with a different willingness and desire to do this work. But the important part of the partnerships is using their organization's strengths to further multiply our efforts. So I give you an example. We're partnering with an organization called Give an Hour, and they provide, maybe you've heard of them, free therapy out in communities. And they also have a stigma reduction campaign, which is really focused on knowing the signs of mental health distress and knowing what to do when you're around somebody who's annoyed or agitated or irritated or angry, and as some examples. And so that's one partner, but we have a host of others that we're engaging with. I should also tell you about our partnership with the Independence Fund. And this is a nonprofit veteran service organization that we've only recently started partnering with around, although I think it's an important intervention. We're pulling together units that have been through a lot of combat exposure and or trauma, and reconstituting those units and providing some psychoeducational prevention content to the units. But the content is critically important, but even more so is the ability of these service members, these veterans, to reconnect, to have rebuild those social connections and those bonds that, they experienced while they were serving together. And we're in the early stages of that. We've done one reunion with them and we have another one coming up, but it is a pilot program. But I just want you to know more broadly the importance of partnerships as our strategy. When we see SPCs working on coalitions and building partnerships to help do this work. And then when we work with them on training, what we call, you've probably heard of the term gatekeepers. Really, this is like training everybody who touches the lives of a veteran, whether that's the front desk worker in our hospital system, or whether that's the person that hands out towels at the gym, or whether that's the librarian who interacts with them on a computer in the local library. We want to train all gatekeepers on signs and symptoms of suicide risk. And we have a capability online called SAVE, S-A-V-E, and that's our training. It's a 28-minute training, but it's very impactful and teaches people how to ask the question, are you thinking of ending your life by suicide? And then teaches them what to do about it, more importantly. So these are just a few examples of some ways that we're trying to expand our programming into the public health space.
Right. And I appreciate that. And when I talk to people about, you know, public health and, you know, veteran suicide, and sometimes, of course, there's the blank stare. But if we look at the public health approach of, you know, a smoking cessation, right? You know, it's not just the oncologists that are the ones that are trying to address smoking because it causes cancer, drugged or alcohol driving, right? So these are public health risks, and there's a number of them, and suicide is one of them. And taking an approach of saying it's not just the clinician's responsibility. You and I know we clinicians are less likely to come in contact with someone who is experiencing a suicidal crisis than, say, their local clergy or a police officer or those gatekeepers that you're talking about. And so I really appreciate that idea of pushing what we know as mental health professionals that works and putting in the hands of the community so that the community can wrap their hands around this. And it's not just the responsibility of these shrinks in their office.
Yes, exactly. I think it is so important, which is why we're really focusing on this push towards engaging with veterans where they work, live, and thrive. And maybe you've heard of our campaign called Be There, which is also really focused on community efforts like Be There for Veterans. And we're trying to build it out in this coming year to talk more strategically on how people can, quote unquote, be there, whether that's everyday small acts of kindness, like taking a veteran out for a cup of coffee or asking a veteran about their service, or even attending a medical appointment and helping them get transportation to an appointment. I mean, there's lots of ways we can be there for our nation's veterans, but you remind me also about the role of peer support. I'm not sure what your thoughts are on that, but I'm happy to talk to you more about just how unique peer support plays out in our military and veteran population.
Right. I am. And in many ways, you know, I retired after 22 years and I went on to get a clinical degree. So in some ways, I am a super peer as far as those of us who have lived experience. And I absolutely do recognize the place of peer support. I have several of my colleagues at our local VAC BOC are peer support specialists, great assets to maybe those clinicians who don't have that lived experience. And I've had a couple of episodes on peer support before. We have to be very careful about peer support though, because just saying I'm a veteran and I want to help other veterans, we can do more damage than help if we're not properly trained as peers and know how far our expertise goes and when to pass it off to somebody else.
Yes, I'm glad you brought that up. That is critically important. And we're not trying to overwhelm peers or put them in the role of a mini clinician or anything like that. It is a fine line. And I think that it can be very helpful as like adjunct care or helping people who are struggling with some symptoms. But if somebody's at high risk and really thinking of ending their life and has a plan and all that goes with that, we want them to immediately be passed off to our veteran crisis line or brought directly into the emergency room or, you know, call 911. Any of those are the first go-to. I wouldn't send someone, you know, also very high risk for just peer support alone. But I think when we can get peer support early, like upstream, and it's part of everyday life in such a way that the veterans don't feel isolated and don't feel like they have someone to talk to, so that they're not a burden and that they fit in their group. And that group might be like a veteran affinity group, or it might be like a group that brings them meaning or purpose. That's when we know we're doing good work, I think.
No, I absolutely agree. And the idea of peers, it doesn't even necessarily have to be other veterans, right? If veteranism, or a colleague of mine who works with student veterans as a clinician, says that often at some point the veterans that he worked with will transition from hanging out with all veterans to hanging out with other econ majors, or hanging out with other, you know, business majors, right? And so whatever that peer group is, knowing that there is that veteranness, but it's this being able to enable, and this is one thing that I've kind of conceptualized, and you can confirm this if you believe it to be true as well. Veterans are used to helping other veterans, right? Because my shield covers my brother and my sister. And so by engaging veterans in peer support for other veterans, that's even a protective factor for their own risk to suicide.
Yes, I think so. And they get meaning out of that and helping others. So I think you're right. And I also appreciate you bringing that up, because the piece on where they can transition from working with econ majors, for example, because I think that is, you know, longer term goal is to help veterans feel like they fit in their environment, whatever that environment is. And it, for some, you know, transitioning and socializing more broadly over time is very normal and appropriate. You know, we're also trying to think through the role of family members in this equation. And we know that family members sometimes are the key people that see the risks first. So we're trying to leverage our outreach strategy also to family members, like moms and dads and spouses. And so peers, certainly important, but family members are kind of in that same equation too.
Yeah, absolutely. You had mentioned earlier, I think, the National Academy study, which is, I think, now January of 18, probably when it came out. We actually had Dr. Kara Query on the show. And in one of those studies, or in that study, it showed that veterans are more likely to access mental health care that they need if they have a supportive family environment. I think it was something to the magnitude of 50% more likely to engage and find success in treatment if their family members, and I think it specifically said family members. And so you're talking about, we haven't talked about the word PTSD or the acronym PTSD in this whole thing. You're talking about these other ancillary, it's not even mental health. It's connecting to others. It's my family. It's purpose and meaning. It's how do I meet my needs after the military? It's these other things that are not necessarily out of the realm of mental health professionals, because we do have, you know, family systems theory and existentialism and things like that. But it's not just for mental health professionals to solve.
Right. Yes. This is also a big part of our strategy going forward. Like we last year published this, the National Strategy for Preventing Veteran Suicide. And in that strategy, we list 14 goals, and a number of them are focused very squarely on evidence-based practices in hospital settings and, you know, improving our predictive analytics based on healthcare data. But even more so, a number are focused on building healthy communities and coalitions, and working with key gatekeepers that are outside of the hospital system, so that people's risks are dealt with very early in such a way that they're not becoming chronic and complex over time. And so that when they do get help, the time involved in getting help and getting on a good path is shorter, and we're putting the right protective systems in place in such a way that they can get on a path for success easier than, for example, waiting and having, you know, situations that are so complex that need to be dealt with in inpatient settings and in complex medical environments, if you will.
Right. And I think that has a larger effect of if we start engaging these gatekeepers, you know, again, the front desk people, or the, you know, the waiters in the restaurant, or bartenders would unfortunately,
yes,
probably be a good idea.
Yeah.
You know,
that's a great idea.
Where it's not just, yes, the rising tide lifts all boats, because, and you mentioned before we talked, or before we started recording was that the veteran suicide epidemic exists in a larger epidemic. I firmly believe that if we can in some way solve some of the veteran suicide challenges, we can apply that to the community writ large. But one example, El Paso County, where Colorado Springs is in Colorado, we have the largest suicide rate and number in Colorado. In 2016, veteran suicides counted for 50%, but there were 134 non-veteran suicides. I'm not sure how many of those are military affiliated, but really it's a large epidemic in the veteran population, but it's an even larger epidemic in the nation as a whole.
Yes, we see the national numbers rising, and we see that this is a societal issue. And we nationally, that's interesting what you share about El Paso County, because nationally there are 123 people who die a day by suicide, and 20 of them are veterans. 20 of the 123 are veterans and or active duty. And so I do agree with you. If we apply strong public health approaches and we work with upstream interventions over time, I think that we will make a difference, and we will see a reduction in our veteran population death by suicide. And that will change the national narrative and the national rate as well. I think there's probably also equally some more work to be done in the national level, specifically when you look at some of the data on the youth suicide and the rising numbers of youth that are taking their life by suicide.
As someone who has studied this, I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on perhaps why, either in the veteran suicide epidemic or the suicide epidemic writ large, perhaps, and it is a very complicated question we may not have time for, but why is it going up?
I know it is a complex question, and I'll tell you some of my thoughts on it or what I've been hearing and some discussions with colleagues as well. It's something that we, I think, need to study more with this recent upcoming cohort of young people that are advancing into their early 20s and either joining the military or not, or becoming a veteran or not, is our societal changes around connectedness. And so I think that down the road, there's likely to be more research to be done on young people that grew up in this current generation with iPhones attached to them and with instant access to their network and video gaming, and using their network in that way, vice perhaps the way that you and I might have had a network when we were younger, where we went outside and we played with colleagues in the neighborhood, or with friends, I'm sorry, in the neighborhood, and we interacted and we learned problem solving skills in a different way. I think, of course, technology is wonderful and we all appreciate it, but there's something to be said about isolation when you're playing video games or on social media or connecting with people in different ways than perhaps we've connected in the past. And what does that mean across generational cohorts over time for individuals that grew up in that environment? And have we adequately prepared them for the important role of human connection and avoiding overly being isolated? And coupled with that, I think, is when you don't have a lot of connection over time, practicing problem solving on human relationships. So we see in a lot of our veteran data, relationship issues at the heart of, at the crux of a lot of our suicides. And I shared before, it's like, it's upwards of 20 factors at play. So don't get me wrong, it's not relationships alone, but just this notion of building strong connections with others, and then being able to problem solve when you have complex relationship issues. I'm wondering about this current cohort coming through, this current generation, and how we've changed in this regard. And are they prepared to handle the ups and downs of relationships and to problem solve them and to develop them and to connect with others when they're doing well and during times of need? I don't know what your thoughts on that might be.
No, as a father of an 18 and 19 year old, I have certain very specific thoughts and some of them ringing true. but yes, I mean, there is in obviously this idea of connectedness. We can be increasingly, paradoxically, we can be increasingly connected while also being increasingly isolated. The idea of maybe dating myself here, but the idea of Howard Hughes is the recluse and nobody sees him. Well, Howard Hughes can be a recluse and still be, you know, connected and communicating, but still be isolated. That's an interesting factor. And even to the point of now, it's increasingly easier to basically curate your world so that you're only speaking to perhaps other veterans, right? Online, right? And not even communicating, not even leaving the house for days, but you're still talking to your buddies or, I mean, so it is definitely an interesting aspect that I hadn't considered.
Yes, it is. And you add another layer of depth to it, this idea of curating your own circle. And then we see social media risks on suicide. So like what, you know, and I know Craig Bryant has done some of the research on this with active duty and looking at veteran issues as well. But I mean, people are putting their risks online where they're writing that they're thinking of ending their life, or they're using coded language on social media posts. And they're saying things like, I wish it all would end, or I want the pain to go away. And you have to wonder, like, are they struggling with a pain management issue? Or are they also thinking of ending their life? So it is a hard, complex issue to get after. We're in the process now of trying to make sure that we're responding and training people on the fact that these risks are out there on social media and that this isn't attention seeking. This just is a 2019 issue for us. And so when friends see another friend online, right, that they wish it would all end and they want to go to sleep and not wake up, one of the 332 friends on that page should probably say something to them and make sure they have access to the Veteran Crisis Line and make sure they know that there is hope and that, you know, there are people that care about them and that we want to do something. We want to help them. So this is also just part of the changing evolution of society, I think.
No, and I agree. I'm just considering this idea of if a bunch of buddies were sitting around and somebody happened to say that, you know, struggling with, you know, it'd just be better if I wasn't here, this day sucks, they could actually have a conversation and go deeper and dive into that meaning. Whereas if you're on social media, it's like you shoot a bottle rocket in the air and then you retreat back in the darkness and you don't have to respond to anybody who wants to delve deeper into, is that pain, or are you just having a bad day, or are we in a crisis? And that makes intervention, and we are talking about intervention, unfortunately, because we're at the point of, you know, we have a lot of suicides that need to be intervened daily. But it makes intervention that much more difficult, especially if veterans or their friends, don't know how to do that.
Yes. And it is amazing. I not only veterans or their friends, but one of the other things you remind me of is I recently was at a research discussion about this, and somebody quoted a research study that had been done that even looked at mental health providers and their familiarity or comfortability or competence level in assessing suicide risk. And I believe they quoted something like 70% of our own mental health population don't self-report as being comfortable engaging with clients at risk of suicide. So it just speaks to how complex this issue is and how we need to provide ongoing training for our own field, but equally so get others comfortable, as you mentioned, like asking the question, are you thinking of ending your life? And understanding what to do if someone says yes, like you must take action. Don't leave them alone. Get them to help. This is a critical time. And I think as a nation, if we got to a place where people were stigma, we were able to make a dent in the issue, further dent around stigma reduction and get people more comfortable talking about suicide risk in a way that's helpful and messages of hope by sort of glamorizing it or, you know, talking about it in a negative way. I think that we could make a change with that little step as well.
You know, I appreciate you bringing out that that fact about mental health providers even. And I know I'm mentioning a lot of previous shows here, but we did have Stacey Friedenthal on the show who said that very thing. And that's one thing that she says over and over and over again is that providers need to be more comfortable in asking that question. And even before I was before I left active duty, I was an applied suicide intervention skills trainer. And one of the things that I used to. Right. And
I'm familiar with that model.
a great gatekeeper program. And my thing always, one of the things I always said when I was training is ask the group of veterans or service members actually that I was training, you know, would you do anything to save a buddy, right? You'd run out into, you know, fire and bullets and everything. Everybody's like, well, absolutely I would. I said, but would you have enough courage to ask them point blank if they're willing to take their own life or thinking of taking their own life? And everybody sort of rocked back in their chairs. But it's really the same thing. We're willing to be physically courageous, but this is a different level of courageousness to being emotionally courageous, to be able to step out and say, are you thinking of taking your own life?
Yes. And I think one of the good things about the assist model back in the day and other models like it is they actually have you practice it. Do you remember doing that where you have to practice the skill? Mm-hmm. And it feels silly, I think, in the classroom environment to do it, or it feels a little bit clumsy and uncomfortable, but the practice really does matter. And turning to your neighbor and actually getting the words out of your mouth and being comfortable with it, I think does give you the necessary skill to actually do it if you had to do it in real life.
Right. Absolutely. You know, I was, I jumped out of airplanes 35 too many times in my military career. And, the first day I went to airborne school, they didn't say, here's a parachute, jump out of the airplane. We practiced and practiced. They jumped from walls and threw us on the ground and stuff like that. And that's what we did in the military was we went from no skills and repetitive training up to large skills. And that's how I try to approach it with the community members is to say, just like anything else, you have to build up the reps to be able to be comfortable with this. And eventually if we get there, then maybe it'll make a difference.
Yes, I do. I'm going to probably try to use that example as I talk about it now, like just like the military trains and does the reps, because it is something that you have to revisit. You can't just not take the training and then think you're going to be comfortable talking about this. And then once you take the training, we probably have to refresh it over time. I'm always amazed when people will share a story whereby they thought that they used it and they were successful getting someone into help. And they later report that they are so comfortable doing it now. Like it just took that one first time to get them, you know, over the hump where they're like, okay, I can do this all the time now. And I think they're afraid if they ask it that they're going to turn the person off or that they'll offend them or that, you know, it's too risky for them. But it's a risk we should be willing to take, right, if it means saving a life. So,
right. That emotional courage to go along with the physical courage. I did not even touch the tip of the pyramid of what we could possibly talk about. In the last few minutes, I'd like to give you an opportunity to maybe give some final thoughts.
Yes, absolutely. Thanks so much. I appreciate the opportunity to dialogue with you. And I think that when we get conversations like this out into the mainstream, this is part of the solution for trying to, you know, change the national dialogue on suicide prevention. And here at the VA, we're really pushing bundled strategies. And so we're trying to build on the existing good work of the Veteran Crisis Line, where they are every day working hard and making actual saves of people that are at very high risk, and building on the existing work where we're providing evidence-based practices in our hospital system, to now looking outside the four walls of the hospital and encouraging our staff to know the data and know who's at risk of suicide within our veteran population, and design interventions that are outside the hospital system to capture those veterans at an earlier time in the risk trajectory, if you will, and intervene earlier and with a whole host of potential strategies. And so I appreciate the opportunity to push that out and share that information with your audience. And hopefully we can continue to have conversations like this with you as our programming advances over time. Thank you so much.
Yes. I mean, I am personally fascinated with the potential of the Reach Vet program. As you said, the predictive analytics, I think there's a lot there, and we can and probably should have an entire show just on that. And again, it didn't get to the groups and the individuals. And, so definitely would like to have you or someone from your team back on to continue this conversation. If somebody wanted to connect and maybe find out what the Office of Suicide Prevention is doing, how can they find you, website, social media, things like that?
So I would send your audience members to betherefortveterans.com, and that will push them right into our website, which offers a host of information on our VCL and all of the services that are available for veterans, as well as our copy of our National Suicide Prevention Strategy, which provides actionable items that people could just pick up and execute at their level as well. If they're wondering, what can I do to prevent suicide? Is there anything I can do at my level? Definitely go to the Be There for Veterans website, and you'll see a host of ideas and actions that you could take.
And we'll definitely make sure that all of those links are in the show notes. Thank you so much, Dr. Franklin, for coming on the show today.
Yes, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
You're listening to Headspace and Timing, where we're trying to change the way that we think and talk about veteran mental health. I appreciated Dr. Franklin coming on the show. One of the things she highlighted was how the VA Office of Suicide Prevention is taking a public health approach to addressing suicide in the veteran population. I've recently written a series of articles about the public health approach can be applied to the service member, veteran, and military family population, which I'll link to in the show notes. Essentially, it means that we have to increase the factors that protect a veteran from getting into a suicidal crisis and reduce the risk factors that put them there in the first place. Dr. Franklin talked about the National Strategy to Prevent Veteran Suicide, and the Center for Disease Control also talks about increasing protective factors while reducing risk factors. When we're talking about the veteran population, that means we need to increase connectedness, economic stability, and education and awareness around veteran suicide. Those are the protective factors. When it comes to reducing risk factors, communities need to increase access to effective treatment, help veterans and their loved ones restrict access to lethal means during a crisis, and provide postvention support. As my colleague Tony Williams often says, suicide is a national problem with a local solution. Dr. Franklin mentioned in the show, everything they're doing at the national level is great, but it's the efforts that the VA is doing at the local level and partnering with their communities to do so that's going to make a difference. Thanks for taking the time to listen. If you want to find the show notes for this episode, go to veteranmentalhealth.com/HST128. If you want to show your support for the work that we're doing, make sure to subscribe in the podcast player of your choice. We're always looking for guests, either veterans or those who support them. You can drop me a line at info@veteranmentalhealth.com to recommend guests, or you can go to veteranmentalhealth.com/guest to fill out a suggestion or request. I'm happy to announce that I've released a paperback version of the first Headspace and Timing book. It's been available on Kindle for a couple of years, but now you can get it along with Combat Vet Don't Mean Crazy. To check it out, go to veteranmentalhealth.com/HST book. Just a reminder that the guests and information on this show are for educational purposes only and not meant to be considered professional advice. While I am a practicing therapist, I'm not your therapist. If something you've heard makes you think that you should talk to somebody, then reach out to do so. I'd like to thank Doc Todd for giving us permission to use his track, Not Alone, from his album Combat Medicine. Doc's trying to bring the discussion about veteran mental health out of the darkness, and you can see all of his work at therealdoctodd.com. Make sure to join us for the next episode. Until then, remember, veterans, you're not alone. Ever.
The struggle is real, found a feast and lost a soul. Eventually my drinking, it got out of control. There in darkness I roam, struggling to find home. See, suddenly death didn't feel so alone. 22 a day, destination unknown. It could have been avoided if you picked up the phone. But now you're gone, so I guess all we get is the tone. Nothing but bone weeds, overgrown, pushing up stones. I've triumphed over enemies, co-creating enemies. Broke out facilities that tried to put an end to me. R.I.P. I'd rather grind in tranquility. Authentic tendency, embrace my ability.
Carry on and keep staying. Stand up. How this life's
guys. Take those bottles out, dog, and pour them in the sink. Take the needles out your arm and the gun away from your forehead. It's time, man, you've been through enough pain. Stand up. It's time to stand back up. All my veterans, man, Army, Marine Corps, Navy, Air Force, Coast Guard. Get up, you know.